qualities of City of Cambridge retirement system, which is also sort of asset management work at all. Mr. Green?
Good morning, may I please report?
Good morning.
Kevin Green on behalf of the Allen Zender Employees Retirement Plan, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
There's an adage in the law that goes something like this, that I'll give you substance, and I'll take procedure, and I'll beat you every time. This case illustrates that adage is not always true, but it should be, because all procedural rules on leave to amend, at the pleading stage especially, favor the plaintiff. And this could really be a simple argument of 60 seconds that however you slice it, district court here needed to grant leave to amend under the circumstances presented.
But didn't you present your proposed further amended complaint, and although it was not admitted that the district court reviewed that in saying this amendment would be no point to it, wouldn't solve the problem?
The district court did, and we believe that's erroneous. It was a somewhat cursory analysis of a couple of pages. And at that point, I think the record indicates pretty clearly that the judge was done with the case. And I understand the judge expressed some irritation with the initial proposed amended complaint that included some word processing errors, but that was corrected on reply and support of the motion for me to amend. Your Honor's question goes directly to futility, and we have three issues that are presented on appeal, only two of which the district court addressed: falsity and loss causation. And I want to step back for just a second to factually, contextually, how this arose. And factually, this is a complicated case. It's got an alphabet that soup of acronyms. But the resolution, again, I think ought to be straightforward. Aquanet is at the middle.
Before we get into the issues of falsity and loss causation, just as a threshold matter, you seem to be arguing that Third Circuit law here mandates leave to amend, and we should be treating a consolidated complaint like a first complaint for purposes of Rule 15. What authority is there for that proposition?
To clarify, we're not saying that there's an absolute right to leave to amend. Of course, there is not. I would say it's about 90-95% on this record. It's a very strong right for a number of reasons. The judge dismissed for insufficient particularity as to the statements. The judge made some significant conclusions in the motion to dismiss order. The district court ruled that he pled the true facts. In other words, my statements are false, and that's significant under Third Circuit law. Loss causation, you haven't given me enough on the related party transactions and conflicts of interest. And that also goes to particularity. And Third Circuit law, I will not say it's absolute because it is not. But it's very strong that leave to amend is granted under those circumstances. Judge Roth's question goes to, what difference does it make? Because the proposed amended complaint was in the record. And that's where this case really went sideways, I think. Because all this really should have just been litigated in the district court. In response to the motion for leave to amend, actually the judge didn't grant it, the defendants responded that, well, the complaint shouldn't be allowed, and reserved arguments on futility, saying we're not going to address those now because that complaint hasn't been filed. And so we're in a somewhat awkward posture where that is the operative complaint and it's been treated as such. But the district court looked at it just in frankly, a very cursory fashion.
Well, you're saying that because they decided against you, but there's nothing to indicate that during the 3 days that the court had the proposed amended complaint, it wasn't carefully considering what was said therein with the court's knowledge of why the previous complaint had been insufficient. Were these problems solved? And I think the court certainly had plenty of time under the circumstances to give a very thorough examination to what had been added in the proposed amendment.
I think the court had time, but the question is...
You say it didn't have time because it decided against you, but
no.
Isn't that delving the procedure from the result you don't like?
I'm simply saying that the court determined futility in a complex securities case in 3 pages.
But the court was very familiar with the case.
Yes, but the question on de novo review of this, of futility, is whether that holding is erroneous.
All right, what is it that you say that AAMC should have disclosed that they didn't disclose that constitutes the falsity?
The complaint is comprehensive, starting at Joint Appendix page 632.
Can you move your microphone up a little? Sir, can you move your microphone up a little bit? Yeah.
I can give the court a couple of examples of what was not disclosed and what was said that was false.
Well, tell me what it is.
Sure. For example, starting at Joint Appendix, page 632, the principal criticism in the dismissal order was, you're talking about other companies. Now, these are all connected to each other without government consent, right?
I understand.
Right, and then the outcome-related companies. But you haven't given me enough as to AAMC. And respectfully, the proposed amended complaint does that. And for example, on page 632 of the Joint Appendix, AAMC, and I'll try to keep the reading to a minimum, held a conference call where it said the Kedar model is providing existing operating infrastructure of our partners, where Auckland provides non-performing loan services to residential and outsourced provides renovation research.
Can you read a little slower? I really, you're running your words together.
Understood. That the Kedar model is existing operating infrastructure of our partners, where Auckland provides the non-performing loan services, the residential RESI.
What about that is false? I mean, let's go to the heart of the matter on falsity as to the servicing representations, because the nature of those statements seem at worst to be puffery, and as to other statements, they're simply factual recitations of the way the servicing agreement works. How do we have actionable falsity?
It's actionable falsity because Auckland, between 2010 and 2014, grew tenfold and couldn't service all the loans. And defendants, and this is AAMC, and their the complaint.
They were the largest, weren't they the largest servicer of these loans in the country?
I think by 2014, but there's tenfold growth that they can't manage.
Well, I mean,
and they're telling the public.
Even if that disclosed, even if that were disclosed, does their servicing have to be perfect?
It doesn't have to be perfect, but you can't tell the public that everything is okay with Auckland when you've got Defendant Irby, who's the chairman of Auckland and the related companies, and so he knows about this. At least it's a reasonable interest. That the servicing capabilities, and I'm at the Joint Appendix now, page 640. The servicing capabilities of Auckland are superior to other servicers, and this is in 2014, and by that time, Auckland is being investigated by 49 to 50 state attorneys general, and its own technology officer says our technology is a train wreck, we can't service these companies.
But is it worse than other companies? I mean, the statement is that Auckland is better than other servicing companies, but how do we, nothing said about that. Well, I'm just complaining about that Auckland can't do it, but the statement that you're claiming is false is that Auckland is better than the others, isn't it?
At a minimum, it's misleading. I mean, to say it's superior to
the service. Well, maybe it's better than the others. I mean, how do we know?
I think it's a disputed factual issue among many.
But there's no evidence as to whether the others are adequate or not.
I would love to take this to summary judgment
and so how can you say if there's no evidence whether Aqua is better or not better, how can you say it's false to say it is better? We don't know that.
Well, I think as Your Honor just stated that we don't know that because we don't have a record on it, but at a minimum it's misleading. And so I see my time is running down and I just want to emphasize that.
We'll be generous with the time here. We understand there are a number of issues to cover, and we welcome your assistance and your colleagues looking through those issues.
Thank you, Your Honor. That the proposed amended complaint addresses the district court's principal criticism on lack of particularity. The statements are identified as to AAMC. At a minimum, they are misleading when Auckland is coming apart at the seams by 2014. And then defendant Irby needs to resign as chairman of all companies in early 2015 when the class period concludes.
The statements that you point us to were things like it provides significant competitive advantages. Auckland has established distressed mortgage loan servicing techniques and platforms. We intend to capitalize on the servicing capabilities, which we view as superior relative to other servicers. It provides a competitive advantage. Isn't that the classic general kinds of statements that are categorized as either puffery or statements of opinion?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because it's central to the business of what they do. And I've never seen these things on conference calls with analysts and others because they are material. They are important to investors. And in fact, that conclusion were correct, and the Martin Court must have gotten it wrong on that. And in this case is, I don't have a chance to get into this, but is factually, I think, closest to Martin, except of course Martin is RESI, understood, but is largely the same case in that respect. Going back to the
in the Southern District of Florida reached a very different conclusion on this same issue.
Under a different circuit law, but I mean, what I'm saying is that I think Martin is the closest case because of the link between AAMC and RESI that the district court acknowledged in its dismissal order. The district court said you've shown the nexus between AAMC and RESI and RESI and Hockley. But what you haven't given me are false and misleading statements as to AAMC and the proposed amendment complaint. Does that along with loss causation. On leave to amend, the touchstone is very familiar, is prejudice. And the defendants don't argue that there would be prejudice here in considering this. And the plaintiff's side, we're in a difficult position now.
Let's come back to falsity, because I want to make sure I understand your argument. You seem to be claiming that the statements as to the servicing are false because Aqua servicing was not a benefit, was not superior, but in fact was a liability. Where do you plead that there was any adverse effect as a result of the problematic servicing on either RESI or AAMC that would support the notion that representations that its servicing provided a benefit or false?
I think the effect is shown in among other ways by the loss causation. The stock price went from nearly $1,000 a share to around $300 by the end of the class period as the truth came out.
But what is the incident? What caused the loss? What revelation was that caused the loss?
Auckland grew tenfold in 4 years between 2010 and 2014. And by its own description, and technology is really the key because AAMC and one example, Joint Appendix at 640 emphasizes Ockman's superior technology, when in fact Ockman didn't have the technology to service those loans, to the detriment of homeowners. So that's why you have all these regulators involved nationally.
So what caused, there was publicity then about Ockman's inability to service? Why would that affect AAMC's stock price? Did it affect it?
Because, but the course description, and as alleged, these companies were all interrelated. AAMC, as it is, its only client, is RESI.
Okay, we have loss causation on such a vague description of what the problem was?
Loss causation is detailed at Joint Appendix page 656, and I don't have time to go into details, but I don't think it's fair. It goes into, and it's really complete, but it goes into detail as to how the stock price fell in response to growth.
But doesn't the fact that within a month the stock price rapidly climbed, doesn't that show that the information about the CFPB settlement was immaterial?
Well,
it jumped higher than it went down within 30 days.
Well, that's one event affecting the stock price. And on loss causation, I don't have the decision in my head, there needs to be a full record. I mean, a case like, say, I think it's McCabe, that on summary judgment, to determine, say, with an event study, that what caused it to go up or caused it to go down on a given day.
But this is where we need to distinguish between statements that may merely inflate price and that are actually causing loss and which we contribute loss causation as that term is used. Right?
Yes, understood.
And what specific allegations can you point us to in this complaint that reflect that Ockman was not adequately servicing RESI's non-performing loans?
The New York Department of Financial Services investigation so concluded and acted to protect borrowers. And I know I have that highlighted. I can provide the site on rebuttal. But that was just one of the regulators that drew the conclusion that Ockman was in a perilous position in terms of servicing these loans.
Talk to us about the related party transaction policy. Here the district court concluded the problem was you could point to a specific transaction, even in the proposed amended complaint. So how specifically, without that, you pleaded that the related party transaction or the related party transaction policy as to AAMC is false?
I believe that's alleged, Your Honor, at joint. There's one transaction, for example, a $65 million transaction involving insurance, the $65 million that flowed into the coffers of AAMC that was approved by defendant Irby, who, like I said, he recused himself, and that's alleged at joint appendix pages 624, 658, and 661, and discussed in the library.
Isn't that a specific transaction, the one you identified with ASPS?
It could be, Your Honor, but that's one of the related companies. But
identifying a specific transaction as to other of the related companies, that doesn't answer the concern of the district order or the question I'm asking now about what specific transaction involving an actual conflict is pleaded as to AAMC?
I think that's a conflict because the chairman of all these companies said he would recuse himself from all related party transactions, and he didn't do that.
He may not have as to other related companies, but what is pleaded that he did not do that specifically as to AAMC?
Your Honor, I think the example I've given answers that in light of what he, defendant Irby, told investors. I don't have other examples in my fingertips at the moment.
But in this litigation involving AAMC, don't we need to see how AAMC is affected rather than one of the other corporations in this broad spectrum of related companies?
Unquestionably, yes.
What are you pleading? Certainly there's a drop in stock price when there are announcements of significant settlements, but those are things that one typically sees in the marketplace. What is pleaded to support the notion that the decline in stock price on loss causation as to the related party transaction policies resulted from corrective disclosures about the related policy transaction?
In terms of proximity and time, there's the December 2013 investor conference, as discussed in the complaint, where investors are told that defendant Irby, who founded Aquaman and is the chairman of all these companies, will recuse himself from the related party transactions. And for example, joint appendix at page 655, just 2 weeks later, the CFPB comments that Aquaman violated consumer financial laws at every stage of the mortgaging process.
That's not even specific as to conflict, though. Even if your allegation is that there were false representations that inflated, as to the policies around related party transactions that inflated the price, what have you pleaded as to loss causation that ties back to those false statements?
Your Honor, I can only refer to what's alleged here in how the corrective disclosures, and they are corrective disclosures, how they came out and affected the stock price. And the complaint may be stronger in some respects than others. And the district court didn't dispute Aquaman's servicing capabilities diminishing by 2014, even though defendants told the market, and this is AAMC, this is not other entities, that they provide superior technology when, in fact, their technology, as they described it, was an absolute train wreck by that time.
And, you know, here the district court had this case. They had your initial complaint. They had your proposed amended complaint. They looked at it, and they essentially said that you can't prove, even with the amended complaint, you can't prove falsity, and you can't prove loss causation. That's essentially what the district court said. You've showed us your second proposal, and you still haven't gotten there. We're reviewing the district court's determination on futility. I haven't heard anything yet here this morning as to why the district court was wrong, that giving you another chance is futile. That's what we're here to look at.
Well, I can't do anything further than refer the court to the complaint beginning at Joint Appendix 632 that pleads statements by AAMC that were at a minimum misleading. And in that respect, the decision was erroneous.
Okay, and I mean, notwithstanding falsity and loss causation, the other side, Cambridge, is going to argue that in addition to that, there was no scienter.
Correct.
And that's properly before us with our plenary review. I haven't heard anything here this morning that establishes scienter.
Scienter. The court is familiar with a principle known as the core operations inference. And on the facts here, where RESI was so closely tied to AAMC and RESI and employees and so on, it's really the only operation of AAMC. And defendant Irby is the chairman of all these companies. And so it's a reasonable inference and a strong inference that he knows what's going on. The district court didn't address. because I think if the court were inclined to send this case back, it has options. It can hold the complaint sufficient in its entirety. It can hold it sufficient on the issues addressed only by the district court and send it back. But either way, on leave to amend, it should have been allowed here in the district court. And now we're in a difficult position of briefing Sienta for the first time on appeal. We shouldn't have been here in the first place.
Yeah, but if you don't have the other two, if you don't have a falsity and loss causation, it doesn't make any difference whether you have Sienta.
I've got to plead all three, that's correct.
Yeah, right, so, okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Carlson? Is not a justification for dismissing the complaint with prejudice. Yet the district court here, in almost using those terms, articulated that as part of his rationale. But doesn't that suggest that we should be reviewing this decision with particular scrutiny?
I think Your Honor should give the same scrutiny to this decision as you give to any appeal that comes before you.
And that is a plenary review, is it not?
Well, there are two steps to this. The first is that the general matter decision on a leave to amend is for abuse of discretion. But where the decision is made on the proposition that the amendment to the complaint was futile, then you engage in a plenary review. So I agree with Your Honor that that's the scope of review. But is it particularly strict or different from what you normally do because Judge Bartle considered the initial complaint, wrote a thorough opinion, new complaint was put before him that he had every opportunity to see and review and consider against what he said should come before you. It's no stricter standard. It's the normal standard, as I just said.
But you would agree the mere fact that there have been prior complaints is not a basis for denying leave to amend.
So I think the fact that there had been an amendment is relevant to the court's analysis of this case. There was an initial complaint. There was an amended complaint filed in June of 2015. That was not the same complaint. It was an amended complaint. It changes the procedural posture. So when Judge Bartle ruled fully on that proposed amended complaint, and the plaintiffs then allowed in what they allowed in, he was fully entitled to look at that and say, this is futile. This was the the only difference between this case and the precedent from the court in In re Alpha Pharma securities litigation is that here the plaintiffs proposed an amended complaint. In that case, the court said, listen, you were appointed lead counsel, you had the opportunity to file an amended complaint, the court considered it fully, and then you say you got more to say. No, you don't have more to say because what you have to say would be futile. So I think it is a little different than just having one complaint, Your Honor.
Your adversary here has made the point in briefing that where we're talking about a consolidated complaint, and in this context where lead counsel has been appointed and then is filing a consolidated complaint on behalf of all plaintiffs, that that should be viewed akin to an initial complaint.
Yeah, and I don't think that's correct. I mean, I think the court addressed that in the In re Alpha Pharma decision, and because there was, a lead counsel appointed, lead counsel had time to go do their investigation and choose the best things that they had to bring forward. They put that forward before Judge Bartle. Judge Bartle ruled. It was unclear whether his ruling was with prejudice or not. It was silent on that point. And then they bring the complaint forward. I don't think the judge is then required to say, we need to go back into full briefing if the judge reviews it and concludes that it is futile.
Let's address the futility issues first around falsities on the statements as to servicing. Judge Bartle's reasoning was that there was an insufficient link alleged between AAMC and Aquin. How can we affirm on that basis, given the multiple allegations of the close relationships between the companies?
Well, this is where I think the factual context of this case is so important to understand, and a number of Your Honor's questions alluded to that. AAMC was formed in 2012 and spun out of the company AltaSource Portfolio Solutions at the end of 2012. It was formed for a specific purpose, and a sister corporation was formed and spun out of ASPS at the same time, a corporation called AltaSource Residential, which I'll call Resi. Those corporations are very different from Aquin and ASPS. They have a specific purpose, which was to assemble single-family rental properties, and the vehicle through which Resi was going to own those properties was through acquired portfolios of non-performing loans. During the class period, Resi acquires approximately 16,000 non-performing loans, and that's in the record Joint Appendix 393. So in 2013, Resi acquires 8,531 non-performing loans. In 2014, Resi acquires 7,772 non-performing loans. Our client, AAMC, is the investment manager for Resi. This is a small company, and the plaintiffs themselves allege that at the same time, Aquin was servicing 2,861,918 mortgage loans. That's in the proposed amended complaint at paragraph 70. And what the plaintiffs have never done, because I don't believe there's any basis to do so, is to allege that the servicing problems that Aquin experienced at the 2014 had any role or any adverse impact on AAMC. So the plaintiffs have not been able to draw the linkage that Judge Bartle dismissed the initial complaint for, and they didn't cure that in the proposed amended complaint. So therefore, the statements that they challenge with respect to AAMC are not false. There's no adverse effect on AAMC's ability to manage Resi or adverse effect on the 16,000 non-performing loans out of the 2.8 million that Aquin was servicing.
But aren't those different issues? That is, the number or percentage of non-performing loans that are acquired from Aquin versus who is servicing all of the loans of Resi. And the representation in the complaint is that all of Resi's loans are being serviced by Aquin.
Okay.
Some may also have been purchased from Aquin, as I understand their.
So I wasn't speaking to, maybe I misheard your question, Your Honor, and I apologize. The issue is, have they pleaded a false statement, which is what I heard Your Honor ask about. And to have there be a false statement, there has to be some adverse impact from the Aquin inability to service on what AAMC was doing in terms of advising Resi. During the class period, Resi acquired loan portfolios. As Your Honor just pointed out, they acquired those loan portfolios exception that the plaintiffs have a false allegation in their complaint that said that Resi was dependent on Ocwen for the source of loans. Not true. The loans that Resi acquired were purchased from third parties with the exception of an initial portfolio of about 460. But to have there be a false statement, there has to be an adverse impact on Resi from Ocwen's inability to service the loans properly. There's no evidence of that. There's never been the suggestion that that was the case. What they try to do is say, because Ocwen had problems with managing 2,800,000 loans, that that must have had a problem with Resi.
Well, they're pointing, and this is at the pleading stage, they're pointing to corrective disclosures, albeit made by third parties, not AAMC necessarily, but correct, what they're calling corrective disclosures that lead to a drop in stock price. And isn't their false statement theory that confidence, investor confidence by representations about the excellent servicing abilities of Ocwen, that both inflated the price of AAMC stock, and when those corrective disclosures were made, there was no longer that public confidence, it caused the loss in stock price. What's wrong with that theory as pleaded at this stage, at the beginning stage?
So Your Honor moved to corrective disclosures and away from false statements, and during the questioning of the appellant's counsel, the question was asked, what were the false statements? And he pointed to two. One of them was a statement that our business strategy is working and we're having loans being serviced by Ocwen and Altasaur's portfolio is, running the rental properties that we're gradually acquiring. There's nothing false or misleading in that statement in the first quarter of 2013. The second one he pointed to was a statement from the beginning of 2014, where we believe that the Ocwen portfolio would have a competitive advantage. There's nothing that suggests that compared to other servicers, that the portfolio that Ocwen, the servicing capability that Ocwen provided wasn't superior to others. We put before Your Honor, and it's entirely appropriate given the allegations they put in, the National Mortgage Servicing Settlement. So Ocwen was the fourth largest servicer of mortgages in the United States. There were five other big ones, and those five other big ones had the exact same type of problems and settled for $25 billion in 2012, when Ocwen settled for far, far less than that at the end of 2013. And the issue of settling at the end of 2013 is actually probative to the absence of a false statement, because at the time the CFPB settled with Ocwen, again, we're talking about Ocwen, we're not talking about any adverse effect of AAMC, but you're trying to draw, you're suggesting you wanted an answer to the linkage question. Nothing in that CFPB settlement said that Ocwen couldn't proceed to service or acquire more loans. So there's no inference to draw from that settlement that there was an adverse ability of Ocwen to service the Resi portfolio, which was gradually.
At what point, if any, would Ocwen be required to disclose vulnerabilities and liabilities in Ocwen's business?
So we're talking about Ocwen now.
Yeah. When would AMAC be required to disclose the vulnerabilities that Ocwen was having?
So at the time when AAMC concludes that Ocwen servicing is no longer superior to other potential servicers and concludes that that's no longer the situation, then it should step back and say, it may be that Ocwen is having difficulties and we can't do that. But that's beyond the end of this class period, because the class period ends in January 2015 and the settlement with the New York State authorities was at the end of December of 2014. And there's no public statement that AAMC makes during the period in between December and January that would cause that. The other thing, Judge Fisher, that I'd like to point out is the issues that Ocwen was having with the regulators in both the CFPB and there's some, depending on what the announcement is, some decline in the price of the AAMC stock when there's an issue with ACLU. But that doesn't mean that that's a corrective disclosure with respect to AAMC. The law requires much more than that. The law requires that there be a false statement made by AAMC and then some revelation that the statement that AAMC made was false. There's none of that. There's just this halo effect, if you will, that because ACLU goes down, AAMC goes down. And as Judge Fisher points out, on a number of these occasions, the stock went back up.
We can all agree that statements of optimism are not going to be actionable, but some of the statements that are pleaded in a complaint include from the 2013 10-K, for example, representing as superior to other servicers, the capabilities of Ocwen in terms of cost, management experience, technology infrastructure, and platform scalability. Isn't that sufficiently specific as to the nature of the superior services being provided to qualify as a false statement, and then look beyond that to whether there's a linkage?
So Your Honor alluded to the decisions from Judge Dimitrulius in the Southern District of Florida, and there are two of them, one involving Ocwen itself and one involving HLSS, a company that's really irrelevant to our discussion today. In both of those rulings, he looked at those issues and said, no, that's puffery, that is not actionable. So I don't believe we believe we're superior than listing the four dimensions takes it out of the general non-actionable character. I think that's the law of the circuit, and the Advanta decision in particular, when claiming to be superior was held to be inactionable buffery. There's cases that we cite in our brief from other courts of appeals to the same effect. So I don't think that's different in kind than what other courts have held to be non-actionable.
I understand we wouldn't reach the issue if we agreed with you on falsity, but assume we don't. You seem to be arguing that a corrective disclosure needed to be made by AMC itself to qualify as a corrective disclosure.
So that is the purest paradigm. I don't think that if the Inspector General of the United States would come down and say AAMC was committing fraud, that could be a corrective disclosure, even though it's not made by AAMC. So if you heard me to say that narrowly, I didn't mean it that way. But it does require that there be a corrective. The corrective disclosure has to correct something that AAMC said or did that was false. And that's the linkage that the plaintiffs have failed to plead.
How about on the related party transaction?
Well, let me start with one thing on the related party transaction. Counsel said that there was a related party transaction, and he directed you to paragraph 104 of the complaint, which was a $65 million transaction involving Outsource Portfolio Solutions, ASPS. That is not AAMC. There has never been a conflicted transaction identified by any regulator, by counsel here, that was done and not disclosed. There's just zero. So what they ask you to do is to contravene, in my opinion, what this court has said time and time again, which is that you're not, and this is where Judge Thompson in the Martin versus Resi case, in my opinion, decided the decision wrongly. She allowed an inference that there had been an improper transaction, even though the plaintiffs in that case did not plead one, did not find one, and she said it would be reasonable to infer that that might exist. Well, I think that runs afoul of a continuous line of precedent from this court, and I would, the foundational language is from the court's decision in California Public Employees Retirement System versus Chubb, 394 F3rd, 126 at 145. Unless plaintiff Innocent Securities Fraud actions allege facts supporting their contention of fraud with the requisite particularity mandated by Rule 9b and the PSLRA, they may not benefit from inferences flowing from vague or unspecific allegations. Inferences that may have been justified under a traditional 12b6 analysis. And this court has rigorously applied that concept to reject unsupported allegations. And I would point the court's attention to the following cases. OFI Asset Management, 834 F3rd 41 at 498. In re Alpharma, 372 F3rd 137 at 150. OGSC Partners versus Washington, 368 F3rd 228 at 240. And the court's more recent decision, Williams versus Globus Medical, 869 F3rd 235
at 244. Even if we agree with you that it would not be proper to infer that there was a specific related party transaction with the AMC because of others, does that really go to falsity here, where the representations at issue are that AMC followed policies, procedures, and practices to avoid potential conflicts with respect to dealings with all of the entities? In other words, the representation is as to having policies in place and the investor confidence that seeks to instill seems to go to something broader than a specific transaction with AAMC, but rather that among the related parties, investors can be confident that there are policies in place, including the chairman recusing himself, where there are related transactions.
So, with all due respect, Your Honor, I think if you read the statements that are challenged that AAMC made with respect to conflicted transactions, it is speaking to its transactions with other companies. It's not saying we can police the entire universe of other companies and what they may or may not do. It's saying we AAMC, have policies and procedures in place that we follow, and we will put those in place, but we recognize that there are conflicts. That's what the disclosures from AAMC had. To then infer that there was a breach of that, a false statement with respect to that, based on the existence of an issue between ASBS and Aquam, is not a reasonable, it is beyond what the PSLRA permits.
But what do we make of the NYSDFS consent order that says that the agency uncovered a number of conflicts of interest between Aquin and four other public companies, all of which are chaired by Mr. Irby? AMC appears to be one of those four companies.
I want to make sure that I'm looking at the correct reference. Can you? This is in the December order, the December 2014 order.
This is a joint appendix 625.
This is the allegation of the complaint. Bear with me.
The order itself.
Yes, I'm sure.
It's J1213.
So that order in its full text is in the record. We put that in the record in connection with our motion to dismiss the first complaint. There is no elucidation, no exemplar, no specific with respect to AAMC ever that's been brought forward by that regulator or by any other regulator with respect to an improper conflicted transaction involving AAMC.
Why isn't that really read as revealing an actual conflict as opposed to as I take it, you're arguing a potential conflict?
So, Your Honor, There's, had there been any such, they would have put it in the order. They did not put that in the order.
Questions?
So, well, let me just, I know you're, and I'm way over time, so my apologies.
I'll give you a minute to wrap up.
Okay. I guess I just wanted to touch briefly on, there's no linkage showing any false statement by AAMC, whether it be with respect to the Aquin servicing or with respect to conflicted transactions. Independently, the judge found the loss causation, and then, as we pointed out in our brief, the facts pleaded in this complaint come nowhere close to pleading a strong inference of secondary. And so the case should be, the denial of the leave to amend should be affirmed on a number of grounds, but as I said, most fundamental, because Judge Bartle got it right, the plaintiffs did not correct a fundamental pleading defect. They didn't appeal from his ruling dismissing their complaint, and the court should affirm Judge Bartle. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Green, we've gone over time on both sides, but we'll give you a few minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The court is very indulgent in my opening. I appreciate it, and I'll try to improve. I think what Judge Thompson understood and what has come out of it today is I read all the cases in the last.
AAMC was not a defendant in those cases, though.
Correct. And this is right? The point I'm going to make, and that is that. This case is really neither fish nor fowl compared to
right.
Third Circuit precedents, in that you've got all these intensely close relationships between these companies, as the regulators determined, and as is alleged, and in fact, is not disputed with one defendant who's chairman of all of them. The case needs to be seen in that light, the linkage. As I understand it, it's not really disputed. Judge Bartle found, Joint Appendix page 32, that linkage had been alleged in light of that interrelationship, but you need to give me the false service leading statements as to AAMC, and I recommend that as to why that's been done. So I won't belabor that. So the fact that this is all under intertwined companies, I think, is differentiates this case in some ways from, and really isn't like other securities fraud cases that I've read that this court has decided to talk. Now, if I understood counsel correctly, he said that the complaint was just simply wrong on the fact that it is alleged. And even in a securities case, with the some of the highest pleading standards, the facts are taken as true. I mean, that's a fact dispute for summary judgment for later. And I respectfully think that's a red flag. We have some disputed facts here that warrant this case going forward. Loss causation. This is Rule 8 pleading, and Dura requires simply some indication of loss. And I think the complaint has alleged that to the best of the plaintiff's ability at this stage of the proceedings. And my last point is, I think it's a very fair description to say that in light of how this case was treated below, and the rules favoring leave to amend, that lead plaintiff appreciates this court's particular scrutiny of the decision.
Hey, let me ask you this question. It's sort of a variation of what I asked you before, but on futility. But if we said that we should send this back to allow you to amend your complaint, which Judge Bartle's already looked at and said wasn't sufficient, aren't we just going to end up with another grant of a motion to dismiss on the amended complaint? I mean, I don't see that that's going to advance the ball, particularly when he says, you know, your fourth bite of the apple isn't going to get you any further.
Well,
and it seems to me this is a classic futility.
Well, I think that's how the pleading stage works.
Right.
Just get into this, but the Borelli case.
Yeah, but he's
reiterated in Shane versus Faubert.
Okay.
Contemplates guidance from the district court. I'm not saying the district court tells how to plead the case. District court told us what was wrong with the complaint. This is what you need to fix, and then there was an attempt to do that. And had that complaint been filed, the defendants would have had the right to move to dismiss it, as I'm sure they would have done, and we would have had another round of briefing on that. And that's routine in many cases in the conspiracy.
Yeah, it just seems to me in his order, his July order, he looked at your fourth bite and he said, it's not going to advance the ball.
And respectfully, I think for the reasons stated, he is incorrect about that.
But that's to say you disagree with his assessment of what, in essence, he views as a failure to state a claim.
Correct.
And while it may be couched in terms of the utility ruling, he did look at the merits, and that's what you're asking us to do as well when it comes to what is stated in your amended complaint.
Ultimately, the complaint states viable claims, and the court should so hold and send the case back. Thank you.
So, just getting to that point again, excuse me if you can, I've had a little bit of trouble trying to ascertain where this case would be. You know, we do have plenary review, so we have to look at both the second amended complaint and the proposed amended complaint, and we have to determine whether or not there was anything there to get past the pleading stage. But we don't have that complaint in front of us technically in this case that you're trying to get, that you were asking to have the right to amend. Okay, so you're still going to be back in the district court with a motion to dismiss filed, correct?
If that were to be the holding, that's correct. But again,
and if Judge Bartle just says, I already ruled on this and I'm dismissing this, we would then have your amended complaint, your fourth amended complaint, in front of us to review in a plenary fashion. Is that right?
I don't know whether it would be a fourth amended complaint. Another potential resolution is not to address the answer because the district court didn't. And we've had some.
Not to what?
Not to address the answer because the district court did not address the answer, even at the futility, in its futility determination. So the district court should address that issue because we briefed that in a somewhat awkward posture on appeal.
But in evaluating futility, you're not suggesting that there are additional allegations that you would plead in an amended complaint. You were arguing that it's not futile on the basis of the amended complaint that you did propose and that was reviewed.
That is our argument. That's correct. Thank you.
Thank you both counsel for an excellent argument. We really appreciate it, and we understand this is a complex and important case to both sides. Thank you for the briefing and the argument. We'll take the case under advisement.